Sounds a little like a waterfall, doesn't it? Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. It is not a waterfall. In fact, what you're hearing are tens of thousands of monarch butterflies. And Dave Potras, our engineer, found that sound for us, and it's from their nesting grounds in Mexico. And it was a great way to start the show today. What a sound when tens of thousands of butterflies in the air at the same time. And they've begun their migration, as a matter of fact, as well. Ann Strangeshamps from our office. We have offices on the 7th floor of Vilas Hall on the UW campus, and she sent a general email out yesterday, and she said, hey, if you want to see the monarch migration, just come and look out our window. You won't be able to look. It won't take a minute. It'll be less than a minute, and you'll see some monarch butterflies. So they're on their way, and it's great to have Matt Reitz with us. He is the executive director of the Madison Audubon Society. He's worked on a variety of bird conservation projects internationally and in the U.S., collaborated with universities, state agencies, nonprofits. And today he's with us to talk about the Wisconsin Monarch Collaborative. And we get so many questions on the show relating to monarchs. It's just great to have Matt Reitz with us today to talk about them and certainly to take your questions and comments and maybe your experiences. Maybe you got some good photos that you want to send to our ideas at WPR.org website. We'd love to see those photos as well and your questions. You could also call us at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Matt Reitz, that's a cool sound, isn't it?
It's amazing. What a great way to start.
Have you been to those overwintering grounds?
I have not. It is definitely a bucket list item. I have heard of others who have specifically put that experience on one of their top five lists of things to do. And for the folks who have gone and done it, they said it's been sort of a life-changing experience to see that many overwintering butterflies in one location, making that kind of noise. It's just stunning.
it's stunning. Well, you're with the Madison Audubon Society. How'd you get involved with monarch conservation?
Well, what we do, I love birds, of course, and mm-hmm. I've always loved birds. But at the core of what we do is protecting places and native habitats for wildlife. And when you do that for birds and you do that for other wildlife, it means really great things for ecosystems and people and health and the conservation of our natural resources. So at the core of it, if we're protecting habitat for birds, we're protecting habitat for butterflies and for many different kinds of things. So monarchs are one of those species that it's just they're captivating people.
Yeah, there's not
a lot of folks who don't like monarch butterflies. People really find them just an iconic species. They're well-loved, and they're really a wonderful ambassador for native habitat restoration and management protection. And if you're protecting monarch butterflies, especially at the scale where they operate, because they're global, and they also undergo this incredible migration, which we can talk about, then you're really protecting a lot of habitat for not just monarchs, but for all sorts of different wildlife.
Actually, I was sitting on my front porch with my next door neighbor last night, and we were watching, and every minute or two, here comes another monarch through. So they're kind of on their migration phase, I think.
They are. They've begun their migration phase, so they have a very interesting life cycle in that this particular generation of monarchs is now in what's called diapause. It's not breeding, so it will go and undertake this incredible migration to Mexico. To a very specific, this is the eastern population that we're talking about, east of the Rockies. They'll go down to Mexico, very specific location, right elevation, the right kind of species, these oyamel fir trees, and they overwinter there in the millions. And a very important overwintering site for them that requires ongoing conservation. So they overwinter there. And then the next generation makes will make their way up north to start the breeding season. It's just an incredible, this is a really amazing feat. Yeah. This is an insect that weighs maybe as much as 4 or 5 paper clips, and it is undertaking a 2 to 3,000 mile journey to these overwintering sites. And that's...
it's just amazing.
It's amazing. I mean, if I were to compare it to what a human could do, it would mean that if you'd have to leave the studio, start walking, and then go around the Earth 5 times. So you better get started.
Yeah, I better get started. But before I get started, tell us about the Monarch collaboration.
Well, this is a really wonderful collaboration with a bunch of different organizations. Madison Audubon is one of the leaders in this organization, and it's really dedicated to conservation of monarch butterflies within the state of Wisconsin. And of course, more broadly, regionally,
sure.
And then into its full life cycle. You can go, of course, to wimonarchs.org and see a lot more information. There's a strategic plan on there that talks about lots of different ways where we can help monarchs in the state of Wisconsin. One of the main goals from that collaborative is to really increase the amount of milkweed that is on the landscape. Monarchs have to have milkweed. They need it for the larval stages. They need it for breeding. They lay their eggs on it, and the caterpillar eats that milkweed. And they often will put their chrysalis on that milkweed as well. So they'd have to have milkweed species. So the collaborative has set a goal, and I got to look through my notes here, but it is a lot of stems that are required. Regionally, 1.3 billion stems of milkweed, and the goal is 119 new milkweed stems for Wisconsin. So what that means is that we are going to be working with farmers and agencies and companies that have rights of way and nonprofits and universities, and most importantly, I think, local landowners, people.
Yeah.
There's so much urban green space that we can use in order to create great habitats for birds. And I'm sorry, birds are always on my brain, so I...
But monarchs
as well, yeah. There's a great quote by Doug Tallamy, who is he's an advocate for native habitats. And if we cut the area of lawn in half, we could create the equivalent of a new national park that is 20 million acres in size. So if we put native habitat in just half of our lawn, we're creating an incredible amount of habitat for monarch butterflies and other wildlife.
Dave in Chilton has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Dave.
Hi. About 2 weeks ago, we've got actually in our backyard about 21 hickory nut trees back there. And, of course, they're hanging kind of low with the nuts and things on there now. And we have a lot of alfalfa, and the clovers are blooming at the time. So one evening, as it was getting dark, we noticed butterflies, and we could actually see them from the house, and they were forming huge groups in the trees. And we actually counted 8 different groups in the trees out there, and there was hundreds and hundreds of each, you know, in each group. And as you stood there and watched the sky, you could see them coming in from the fields and coming in as it was getting darker and darker. And just wondering, were they getting ready to head south? Is this something they do at night somewhere and you don't always see it? Or what was happening?
Good question, Kurt. This is something that monarchs do pretty much every night. They roost. So they'll forage all day on nectaring species, all sorts of different kinds of flowering plants, coneflowers and milkweed and asters and goldenrod, etc. And then toward the evening, or right around dusk, you'll start to see them lift up out of the prairies and the grasslands, and they move into trees like hickories and firs and spruce. And they'll do that sometimes in very large amounts. We just the other day, we've been counting roosts at Goose Pond Sanctuary. And last week there was a roost of 1,800 monarchs in one tree. So that was a fun sight. It's very common for them to roost like that at night.
And thanks very much for calling. Julie in Madison, your turn. Hi, Julie.
Hi. I was wondering, I read somewhere that monarchs raised in captivity do not make that trek to Mexico. And I wondered if that was true or if you know if that was true.
That is a wonderful question. There's new research that was published, and I can't remember the journal it was published, but it's a peer-reviewed scientific article that compared... They looked at monarchs that were raised in captivity, both from commercial eggs and those that were actually pulled from the wild, and they showed that there is a loss of migrating behavior, which of course is problematic if these monarchs are not making their way to Mexico to overwinter, and if they're also taking those genes that are no longer migratory and infusing them into the population. So that for a long time, a lot of folks actually raised these eggs and chrysalises in captivity, and that is probably a good thing overall, particularly if it's a wild-caught population. But there is some evidence that can be detrimental to the population overall. It's pretty new science.
So it's a little bit of a worry then.
Yeah. Yeah. So where we thought we were doing really wonderful things for boosting populations might actually be causing some problems as well.
So there you go, Julie. Thank you so much for calling. Kurt, my old friend Kurt Westbrook, sent us a nice photo of a monarch in Columbia County. It emerged in August. It's a beautiful shot. He's a great photographer, and he's got a lot of those photos. We are visiting today with Matt Reitz. He is the executive director of the Madison Audubon Society. We're talking about the Wisconsin Monarch Collaborative. He's answering your monarch questions, and he'll be with us right up till about 12:30 today. We're going to take a look at the news, the weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Matthew Reitz. You stay with us. We'll be back right after the news. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at monarch butterflies today and monarch butterfly conservation with Matt Reitz. Matt is executive director of the Madison Audubon Society, talking with him about the Monarch Collaborative as well. And I'm certainly looking forward to hearing your questions or comments. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Send us your photos or questions also to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Matt, I was with my neighbor sitting on our porch last night, and I mentioned to her that we actually can tag monarch butterflies, and she could hardly believe me, but that's the case, isn't it?
It absolutely is, yeah. There are widespread tagging programs now. I think the first one was started out of the University of Kansas. It's called Project Monarch Watch. And tag involves, luckily when you catch a monarch butterfly, it is a pretty hardy species. It doesn't, the scales don't come off like they do with other butterflies. So if you have them in your fingers, carefully of course, net them and you put them in your fingers, there's a really small sticker that you peel off, you order from Project Monarch Watch. It has a unique identifier on it, and you put it on the forewing, on the outside of the forewing, and right in a specific cell on the butterfly wing that is actually near the center of gravity. It's been shown to have no detrimental effects to the flight of the butterfly, and you're able to track it all through its overwintering season and into the first breeding season over the winter. So it's a pretty fabulous way to learn a lot more about monarch butterflies, which have often, you know, in the past have been very difficult to monitor and track.
So is there something on the sticker itself, or is it that you find the monarch later, or how do they keep track of it?
They keep track of it. Well, you can recite them all along their migration route. If someone sees a butterfly that has a tag on it, and if you're able to look through binoculars or take a photo, or maybe you've captured it in a net, you can report that tag number to Project Monarch Watch. Also, in the overwintering season, there are people who are collecting the butterflies, some of them which have maybe not made it through the winter, or ones that have moved farther north and passed away, and they collect those, and they're able to look to see which ones actually survived the migration south, and which ones are maybe surviving until the next spring. So it's a really great way to get involved in citizen science work. You can order your own tags, but we also host monarch tagging events. There's a 2 days of monarch tagging coming up at Goose Pond Sanctuary. There are spots available. We ask a very modest fee of $10 per adult, $5 per child, and which pays for the supplies. And it's a great way to get out, enjoy nature, get monarchs in your hand. It's a really incredible experience. I love watching, and it's for kids of all ages. We have kids that are 3 and 5 years old out there, and then we have the kids who are in their 80s out there running around in the prairies, too. So if you go to madisonaudubon.org and look at our special events, that's where you'll find a registration link for...
And you, there's still spots.
There's still spots. There's spots for this Saturday afternoon and then the following Saturday, I believe the 21st, for both morning and afternoon sessions. So I would definitely recommend that experience.
And you're going to see a heck of a lot of monarchs there at Goose Pond Sanctuary, which is just north of Madison, a few miles, really.
Yeah, it's about 20, 25 minutes northeast of Madison. And it is a good monarch year. It's a... Populations of the monarch butterfly have fallen a lot in the last 20 years or so, as much as 80% to 90%. There were some bad overwintering and survival estimates from previous years, but they had a nice year last year. Had good overwintering survival and good survival on their way north. So we've had a really nice breeding season. I mean, there's still a lot that needs to be done for conservation of monarchs. One good year doesn't make a recovery. In fact, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has petitioned to list the monarch butterfly as an endangered species. That's under review. So still much to be done. But
there's some hope, at least this last year.
Well, there are lots of threats to monarch butterflies. The primary one, of course, is habitat loss. But there's pesticides and the loss of and herbicides and... predators along the route and weather events, and now climate change is threatening the species as well. So if we are able to create much more habitat, and that's why the collaborative is suggesting people get involved in planting milkweed and nectar producing plants in their properties, it's going to go a long way to reversing some of these trends. So we really need people's help.
Ann in Duluth, Minnesota, will give you a chance now. Hi, Ann.
Hi, you may have answered my question while I was talking to your screener, but we raised butterflies last year, and then I bought really nice cages for this year. And then someone said she read an article that said raising them in captivity was probably not a good idea. And I have a lot of milkweed in my backyard. I used to see little caterpillars, and now I know what the little eggs look like, but I never actually saw a chrysalis. So I thought it was a good idea, but now I'm wondering.
Yeah.
Oh, boy, I don't really quite know how to answer that question. I think the jury is still out on where the balance is between helping populations and potential negative effects caused by rearing in captivity. It is better, seemingly, that you raise with wild-caught eggs and caterpillars than it is to use commercially bought eggs, because those can have more genetic problems. But it's hard. I don't quite know how to answer that question yet. I think it's wonderful that people are trying to help this population, this species.
It's good things there, because obviously she's her own yard and so forth are set up for monarchs and other beneficials as well.
Yeah, and it's great that people care. It's one of those species that people can really rally behind. And again, it's something that you can actually really have an impact on by planting milkweed in places and other nectar-producing plants in places that you're able to.
And thank you for calling. Kevin in Rochester, Minnesota. Hello.
Hi. Do monarchs come in different sizes? I took a picture of one the other day. It was about half the size of a regular monarch.
When they first emerge from the chrysalis, they are a little smaller. They have to pump fluid into their wings, but that usually takes just a few hours. Males are a little bit bigger than females, but probably what you're seeing is a viceroy. And a viceroy is a mimic of a monarch butterfly. They're a little bit smaller, and they also have a little bit of different patterning in their wings. So they have that same sort of mimicking coloration that warns predators, please don't eat me or you'll get sick. So they've managed to copy that, and in fact, they don't taste good either. So you're probably seeing a viceroy. There are some subspecies of monarchs as well. I believe that the Florida populations, which are resident, are a little bit smaller. But what you probably saw in Wisconsin was probably a viceroy.
Yeah, makes sense. Kevin, thank you. Let's go to Glenn in Marinette County next. Hi, Glenn.
Hi. My question is, I was wondering if there's ever been any studies done on the type of mowing operations that have changed in the last 20 years. They went from a sickle-type operation to a brush hog, and it's much more destructive. Instead of laying the grasses over, it chops everything up. I wonder how the damage to caterpillars and cocoons and even the milkweed itself would be a factor. In our little township, we have 125 miles of roads. That's 250 miles of ditches. Mm-hmm. And if you amplify that over the Midwest, I think that would have, would contribute to destruction of the monarch.
Glenn, I think you're absolutely right. I don't know much about the differences in the mower types, but there has been a very large increase in the amount of mowing that's gone on. So all along roadways, there's a much lower amount of monarch habitat, including milkweed, that is found on fence rows and in ag fields and along roadways and in rights of way because it's typically mowed away. One of the things that we encourage is to think about the timing of mowing. If mowing has to happen for safety reasons along roadways, then we encourage municipalities to do it later once the monarchs have had a chance to emerge from the chrysalis and fly away. So I think it's more about the timing. I'm not sure about the differences in the mowing types.
The timing, though, is critical.
The timing is very critical.
There you go, Glenn. Thank you. Jeff in Grand Marsh, your turn. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, good afternoon, you scoundrels. I've heard that only one time, I read this in a magazine, but the monarchs that are leaving Wisconsin today and tomorrow will not be the same generation that arrives in Mexico. Can you enlighten me a little bit?
Jeff, you're absolutely right. It's an amazing thing about their life history that this generation knows genetically that it needs to migrate to this specific location. So this generation right now is its primary purpose is migrating south to Mexico, and it will get to the reserve down there, and it'll overwinter, and then in the spring it will begin migrating north. So they'll make it to Oklahoma, Texas, and they'll breed and lay eggs, and then they'll die. Then the next generation that hatches out will move farther north, and there'll probably be another generation or two before they get back to Wisconsin. So they're basically the great-grandkids of that migrating generation that are finding their way back to Wisconsin, which is just an amazing thing.
Isn't it? But that generation still gets back here.
They do. called home.
Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate your call. That's really fascinating. Mabel in Duluth, Minnesota. Hi.
Yes. 2 years ago, I did my research paper on monarch butterflies at college, and the first thing I want to mention is these people who did the research saying it was not good to raise them, other scientists have said they use faulty data. So I'll let that go there. Monarchs that are raised outside, only 5% live. I started doing this 2 years ago. I raised 61. Then I learned last year how to find their eggs. I raised 225. This year, today, I just let three little boys go. And you can tell the males because they have a black spot on their back wing.
That's right.
I'm up to 395. And like you said, they become asexual in the fall and they go to Mexico to breed. I have a person living in the building with me, and she's from Salinas, California, where they have the Western population. And when I did my research, the Western population is down to only 45,000 monarchs. Another thing I do, my neighbor has a big basswood tree, and she showed me when I walked my puppy, all the butterflies go up in the basswood tree that only blooms for a very short time, but it's just filled with butterflies. But I think people should raise them, and I raise them in quart jars, and every day I date them. I know when they're going to hatch, and I move them over, and I let my little buddies go outside. My neighbors will say, gee, I saw a bunch of butterflies today, and I said, I just let 10 of them go.
Well,
I am very much for people planting milkweed and raising them in their homes and letting them go.
Well, Mabel, you are right that survival of eggs and caterpillars is really low. It's somewhere between 5 and 10%. There's a lot of factors that can go into that: predation, weather, etc. So, you know, that's one of the reasons why folks have taken wild populations, wild eggs, wild caterpillars, and brought them in doors to increase the probability that they will hatch. I haven't taken a very close look at that research paper, but it is in a peer-reviewed journal, that a very high-quality journal. So I would suggest taking a very close look at it. And again, I think that we don't know yet where the trade-offs are. I think it's a very good thing that people are caring enough to bring and raise butterflies in captivity. Again, where that trade-off is, I don't know. But I definitely appreciate people like you who care so much and are doing a lot to try to protect and conserve the species.
Yeah. Mabel, thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. You got a great story there. Appreciate it. Dave in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Dave.
Hi. I have two questions. One is, what do you do with diseased milkweeds? I have some that are turning yellow prematurely. And, well, a lot of them get aphids also. And secondly, can you move butterflies to a healthier place? My yard is not safe from critters.
Boy, that's interesting questions. Well, right about now, some of the milkweed is
yellowing.
So I don't know if it's diseased or not. And a lot of the aphids that use the monarchs don't necessarily destroy the plant. They're getting the latex, the milkweed from the plant as well. They're benefiting from it. As far as moving, I don't know. That's an interesting question. If you've got a pretty dangerous location for a monarch and you want to safely move it to another place, I don't know. I suppose if you're not doing it in mass amounts, it's certainly worth a try.
Yeah, it'd be worth a try. A lot of predation goes on right on the milkweed itself, mm-hmm. if I'm not mistaken. There are other insects.
Oh yeah, there's lots. There's parasites. There's predators. The monarchs have it hard. It's not an easy life for them. It's good. It's a good thing that they are just so darn pretty, because yeah. their life is, it can be pretty ugly in terms of the things they got to deal with.
There you go, Dave. Thanks. By the way, you can join in too with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Maddie in Madison next. Hi, Maddie.
Hi, I just had a comment about mowing. There's some good news. It sounds like a study coming out of the University of Michigan in the last few years has showed that mowing at strategic times, you know, not too frequently, but a few weeks apart, particularly in the midsummer, can actually benefit monarchs because they tend to preferentially lay their eggs on fresher, newer milkweed growth. I guess it's tastier for the caterpillars. And I can say, having worked in restoration myself, I have noticed in areas where I've had to mow that it seems like we do get more monarch eggs on some of those plants. So I wondered if your guest had heard about this, or yeah, just wanted to share the comment.
Yeah, Maddie, thank you.
No, Maddie, I had not heard about that, but it is great to hear from you. Maddie was at one point our land steward at Goose mm-hmm. Pond, and she was fabulous, and now she has this great job working with the city, working on green space, I believe, but she's a fabulous advocate for increasing the amount of habitat that's out there. So honestly, Maddie, you know better than I do in this scenario. I haven't heard about that study, but it makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah, it does make perfect sense. And I hope that information gets out there to those folks who are involved with mowing. That's for sure, along the roadsides and everywhere else for that matter. Thank you, Maddie. We had an email from Christine Tanzer, who is, you may know, the field trip director for the Natural Resources Foundation. She wanted to mention the tagging. They have a tagging events mm-hmm. September 17th from 1 to 1:30. Maybe it's just a half hour, 1 to 1:30. There are 13 spots open. Listeners can go to Wisconservation.org, wisconservation.org/fieldtrips to get some more information on that on Tuesday, September 17th. And again, your work is, your events for tagging are?
This Saturday afternoon, I believe it starts at 1, and then there are two times next Saturday, the 21st, which one which begins in the morning and one which is in the afternoon, and there's plenty of spots in those. Mm-hmm. There are some other organizations as well that are doing monarch tagging, which is fantastic to really spread the good word about this. And so there's more organizations that are participating in it. And you can as well by ordering your own tags and doing it locally.
Yeah, Mike in Lake Mills had a comment about that, if raising. Mike, are you there?
A good point. She was saying that if people are raising them, it would seem to be, it's really their responsibility to tag them, because that's the only way you're going to find out proportionately if raised butterflies do as well as non-raised ones. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for calling.
Great point, Mike.
Yeah, so our earlier caller she should probably consider putting tags on, and you can get the, how do you get the tags?
You go to, you can visit Project Monarch Watch and order your own tags. They do cost a small fee, but they're, I think, pretty reasonable, particularly since the value of the data is so high. So anybody can go online and order them from Project Monarch Watch. I think it's projectmonarchwatch.org, but...
Peter in McQuanago has a question. Hi.
Yeah, hi. My question is sort of multifaceted. I've been interested in the monarch butterflies for many years. I raised some a few years back, and I tried to not do it so much in captivity, but more or less the ones in the yard, just kind of help them out a little bit.
Yeah.
This year, I've got to helping out the blue jays, knowing how important they are for the ecosystem and the oak trees and so forth. And it got me thinking that some of the blue jays migrate, whereas some don't, and then on other years they do migrate. And I didn't know if there was some kind of a social cue. And it got me thinking about maybe the monarchs, if there's some kind of a social cue that could be affecting their migration patterns as well.
Yeah, that makes some sense. There's probably cues, aren't there?
So first of all, thanks for also looking out for blue jays, because what a great bird. That is really incredible, very smart bird that definitely needs, you know, for our respect and conservation. The monarchs themselves, the cues that they use, they actually have been shown to use, well, first of all, like approximate cues, a local cue is the wind. They like the wind coming out of the north. They'll use that, and they'll often start migrating when that happens, when those conditions are right. But they're also using a sun compass, and some have suggested that even some star navigation, a magnetic compass. So their cues are really interesting and very complex, especially for an insect. So just a fascinating life history.
Steve wondered if he grows zinnia flowers for monarch food for the nectar. Must the seeds he use be organic?
Boy, I don't think so. By the time it grows into a full plant, it's producing nectar that will have enough value. And monarchs don't just need milkweed. They'll nectar on a lot of different kinds of things. Native plants are typically the best.
And finally, for signing up for these for this tagging business, where do they go to sign up again?
You can go to our webpage at madisonaudubon.org, and there will be a special events tab. I believe it's under Get Involved or Get Engaged, and the registration link is there. So
there
while supplies last.
While supplies last. There's still some opening. Matt Reitz, thanks. You'll come back, be with us again?
Absolutely.
I'd love to have you again. Matt Reitz, Executive Director of the Madison Audubon Society. We can talk with him about things other than butterflies, too. So we can talk birds, too, with
him.
Sounds
good.
And we'll do it. And listen to that sound. Monarchs in flight in Mexico at their nesting station. On that note, I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.